From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, hear about some of the big issues and races in Tuesday's election.
You know, this is another one of those so-called temporary taxes that is looking a lot less temporary these days.
It's just as easy for a lot of these companies looking to locate in Overland Park, Leawood, Grandview, and other areas. I'd rather have them in South Kansas City.
Not all Kansans are sick of The Wizard of Oz. Meet one who can't get enough of it.
In one of the later Oz books, a princess asks her if she is of royal blood, and she says, oh, no, better than that, I'm from Kansas.
And a musician who changed his tune when he became a father.
I feel like I have a one-to-one connection with my own purpose.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Wyandotte County voters on Tuesday will decide who holds the reins as mayor CEO of the unified government. KCUR's Dan Verbeck has background on two candidates who bring distinctly different approaches to operating the post.
Each serves as a member of the local governing commission. Survivors of a spirited primary campaign and election, the candidates appeared to answer questions posed by a panel in a forum at Kansas City, Kansas Community College. Appearing in alphabetical order.
My name is Mark Holland. I'm fourth generation Wyandotte County, third generation pastor in the community. And I've been serving on the Unified Government Board of Commissioners for the last 6 years as an at-large commissioner.
I'm Ann Murguia, and I'm running for mayor. I have spent my entire adult life working in public service right here in Wyandotte County.
Now, the mayor, CEO of Unified Government of Kansas City, Kansas, and Wyandotte County is a mouthful, so we will call them Mayor and UG. The theme of this evening forum is economic development of Wyandotte County, defining it, planning it, and paying for it. The candidates come at this from two recurring, distinctive perspectives. Holland thinks recent successes have been well refined and the strategy deserves keeping and using. Murguia wants to begin with a study of citizen wants before a plan of action is in place. Four dozen listeners in the audience will hear these themes repeated. Murguia and Holland were asked how they would lead the entire UG Commission for Positive Community Growth. Murguia would run a countywide survey at first.
It would be a countywide survey that was broken down by district, so that each commissioner could understand what the priorities are of the different areas within our community. As you all know here tonight, the priorities out in western Wyandotte County are probably very different than the priorities in downtown Kansas City, Kansas, or even in the Midtown area.
Mark Holland has heard Murguia's talk of surveys often in the campaign.
We don't have time to wait for a survey to find out what people need. We've already done the work, and we know what people need. We know what the constituents have already said to their commissioners, and we've already begun that process. We have a strategic plan in place right now.
Holland adding what a shame it would be to waste momentum built over the last 16 years. The border war between Kansas and Missouri for businesses and jobs creeps into the structured conversation. Cerner Corporation and Google Fiber are growing in the county. Missouri has its own developments, so how would the mayoral candidates keep the spotlight on their community? Holland would spend his first year in office opening opportunities in the Fairfax Industrial District, home of the General Motors plant, looking for new industry.
But this opens up a whole new marketplace for us of a new kind of business that has never been in the Midwest. It's always been on the East and West Coast. We need to strike while the iron's hot, and we already have a team in place for this Google Fiber, but we definitely need to accelerate it. I'm anticipating we have 12 to 18 months to get this in place before the rest of the metropolitan area gets this, and we need to make sure we take full advantage of the opportunity we have to be first in the nation. We don't need to be the first in the nation to have it. We need to be the first in the nation to take advantage of it for our business community and for our citizens.
It is Ann Murguia's turn to counter a tenet of the others' campaign. Holland has suggested a momentum is driving the community. It is, says Murguia, but not in the urban core. It is out on the west side. But she says the center part of the city is growing poverty. She looks to land bank property, acquiring it in an inexpensive price, take blighted property off the tax rolls, and build new homes.
If we had a mayor that was out there that was aggressively marketing what we have in Wyandotte County and aggressively marketing these land bank properties, we might be able to encourage some of those technology businesses to actually locate within our city and grow a whole technology center like they have in places like Boulder, Colorado.
Holland and Merguia and many others expect less state revenue, especially in the next year. So how would they cope with it? Holland says federal and state cuts are the greatest threat to schools and counties right now. Governor Sam Brownback's efforts to cut the state income tax.
Number one, we need to lobby the state, and we need to take a strong stance against Brownback's policies that are hurting all of Kansas and especially hurting Wyandotte County. We also need to take a strong stance addressing all of our city services and finding ways of being more efficient and doing more with less.
Ann Merguia sees revenue for economic development coming in part from the private sector willing to invest.
We have some great partners here in Wyandotte County who are working with the same common goals that we have that we could use and be partners with to meet some of our constituents' needs.
Top immediate goals for Holland include revitalizing the downtown and connecting local people with thousands of new jobs, he anticipates. Merguia would restore livable housing east of I-635 where blight is destroying the community. One of the two will be mayor by day's end Tuesday. I'm Dan Verbeck, KCUR News.
For a long time, Kansas City has supported health services for people without insurance or a means to pay. This is mainly done through a health levy, which is part of the property tax. It brings in about $50 million annually. A portion of the tax will soon expire. Voters in Kansas City will have the chance to renew it on Tuesday. It's question one on the city ballot. And despite all the controversy surrounding health policies and spending right now, KCUR's Alana Gordon reports there doesn't appear to be much opposition to the local measure.
Kansas City's temporary health levy is a 22-cent property tax passed by voters in 2005. The lion's share has gone to Truman Medical Center, the city's once public hospital. John Bluford, Truman's CEO, says when that levy was first introduced, city funding to Truman had been on the decline.
Well, the context was one that the respective institutions lost funding from the general fund. So it was really makeup. We didn't materially increase our total subsidy from local government as a result of that. It kept us whole.
Bluford says the funding from the temporary levy, about $15 million annually, is just as critical today, nearly a decade later. A down economy and big cuts to the state's Medicaid program has meant a lot more people without a means to pay are turning to them for care. Councilman John Sharp volunteered on the original health levy campaign. He recalls his own wishful thinking at that time.
Well, in 2005, when this was put on the ballot, we had hoped that there might be universal health care by now.
Not so. Last year, about 1 in 10 residents sought care that was supported by the levy. And not just at Truman. The levy also funds city ambulance services and area health clinics. It's meant a lot to Michelle Fowler.
Here's our little office. This is where we come to get, like, our renewal.
Fowler recently stopped by Northland Healthcare Access off of Berry Road to renew her membership in one of its programs that connects patients with providers who've agreed to offer discount services.
Every 6 months, you get basically a little piece of paper that you show your doctor authorizing that you can get care.
Fowler has her own business and waits tables, but her restaurant stopped offering insurance a few years ago. Days before her individual insurance plan was supposed to kick in, her appendix burst. And with it, her health coverage, in the form of a last-minute denial letter.
It's overwhelming. If I didn't have anxiety before this, I did after I lost my health insurance.
That was in 2010. Medical bills started piling up on top of daily living expenses. Fowler says discovering Northland Healthcare Access was a huge relief.
I didn't have another option. And when finding Northland Healthcare Access was just, when I got referred to the specialist and my first appointment, she told me I needed surgery. I started bawling crying because I was like, I can't afford surgery. And she said, no, I'm going to donate your surgery. And then I started bawling even more.
The temporary health levy funds about a third of Northland Healthcare Access's budget. Whether or not to now renew that levy for another 9 years will appear as question one on next week's ballot. City council members unanimously moved it to a vote earlier this year. they chose renewing it for another 9 years as opposed to a shorter period, in large part because of uncertainties around the Affordable Care Act and their concerns over the degree and pace at which health coverage may improve. Truman and other supporters launched a formal campaign in support of the renewal earlier this month. It includes support from the Healthcare Foundation of Greater Kansas City, which also funds health reporting on KCUR. Mailers have been sent out, yard signs have gone up, Fowler got involved. But the measure doesn't appear to have any organized opposition.
The folks who stand to benefit from the tax are, of course, going to spend some money to get the tax passed.
Patrick Ishmael is a policy analyst with the St. Louis-based free market think tank, the Show Me Institute. Ishmael isn't surprised by the lack of visible challenges to renewing the levy.
The problem is that the cost of the tax is so widely distributed that, you know, how are you going to get an organized opposition against tax? How often has that really happened?
Ishmael thinks voters need to think hard before deciding on this.
One of my big concerns about maintaining the tax is that, you know, this is another one of those so-called temporary taxes that is looking a lot less temporary these days. And so the question is whether or not Kansas Cityans think that it's the best use of their dollars given these pretty tight fiscal times, not just at the government level, but at the family level.
Approval of the levy in 2005 didn't get widespread support either. Ishmael says problems in the health system also need to be addressed at state and national levels. Cities can't fix this, neither can levies.
I do believe that the city is at least partly responsible.
Crosby Kemper is head of the Kansas City Public Library and is also chair of the Show Me Institute. Kemper personally thinks the health levy is an exception, but he is deeply concerned with the city's overall tax policies and plans. That's something he says residents really need to question when taxes like this come up for a vote.
We passed the zoo tax with a 9% vote. We passed a streetcar with a vote of 300 people. We have all these obligations. We're building this huge tax burden, tax rate problem.
When broken down within all of this, the temporary health levy costs the owner of a $100,000 house about $40 a year. So come Tuesday, voters in Kansas City will get to decide whether or not they think such a tax should continue for area health services for another 9 years. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
As Alana reported, there hasn't been much opposition to the renewal of the health levy in question one. Question three, on the other hand, deals with an issue that's generated heated discussion over the past few years. It's about Kansas City's future in nuclear weapons manufacturing. Sylvia has more.
Kansas City has played a role in the manufacture of nuclear weapons since 1949. That was when a World War II defense plant on Bannister Road began making the non-nuclear components of these warheads. The National Nuclear Security Agency contracted that work to a company called Bendix then. After merger, it's now called Honeywell. At the height of the Cold War in the 1980s, the factory employed some 8,000 workers.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, people were really afraid that the world was going to end in a nuclear holocaust.
It was in the 70s that Rachel McNair first got involved in the movement against nuclear weapons. She joined a group in Kansas City that advocated converting the Bannister facility to a factory that made something else.
At the time, it was a pie-in-the-sky, starry-eyed idealist, you know, easily dismissed kind of idea. We pushed it on principle, and then the Cold War ended. And the Cold War has been over for a couple of decades, and nowadays we have retired military people, we have, you know, military experts, we have the same people who set up mutually assured destruction saying that it's time to get rid of nuclear weapons.
According to the Kansas City Star, the Honeywell plant currently employs about 2,000 workers who maintain the W-76 missile warhead, a submarine-based weapon which is 7 times as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb. The factory is getting old, though, and Kansas City officials were afraid of losing the plant and the jobs to New Mexico. So they offered tax incentives to a private developer, and in 2010, ground was broken on a $1 billion new facility. McNair thought the project made no sense, since the Obama administration is talking about reducing nuclear arsenals.
I just could not stand the idea of building a whole new plant as if we were going to be making new parts for decades.
Anti-nuclear weapon activists in Kansas City tried to stop the incentives with previous petitions. And 2 years ago, some 50 people were arrested in a protest at the construction site. The building's complete now. The NNSA and Honeywell have been transferring operations already. It's supposed to go online in August of 2014. So the question on the ballot isn't to shut down the new plant, but rather it prohibits the city from offering any future incentives to, quote, facilities that produce or procure components for, assemble, or refurbish nuclear weapons. This would apply to companies that work exclusively with Honeywell or any future nuclear weapons plant. According to City Councilman Scott Taylor, this just makes Kansas City look like an unappealing place to do business.
A company, regardless of the size, is looking to locate a new facility. They will usually have a site selection process that has multiple sites. And if one of those sites happens to have something that's different from all the others, it's a little strange and really might require some additional legal work or research to see if they have some legal issues. They'll just take us off the list and move to the other options because it'll be a lot easier for them.
Taylor is the at-large councilman in District 6, where the new plant is located. He says the new building has already helped bolster Kansas City's construction industry through the recession, and he's hoping it will anchor development in a struggling part of town.
Specifically in South Kansas City, we've really been fighting hard for the Three Trails redevelopment of the old Bannister Mall. We've had an incentive package on all that property that's already in place. We've already done that. If a company has any ties to this facility, there's a question as to whether they could even locate there if they wanted to. If they can't locate there, it's just as easy for a lot of these companies looking to locate near this plant to locate in Overland Park, Leawood, Grandview, and other areas. I'd rather have them in South Kansas City.
Taylor says the old Bannister facility was on federal land, so it didn't generate taxes for the city and the school district. The new plant is on private land, so despite the incentives, it will bring in property taxes for Kansas City, Missouri, as well as the Grandview School District, which dips into KC at that spot. Taylor says he understands the intent behind the ballot question.
We all agree that it would be nice if we could all countries would disarm nuclear weapons. That would be wonderful if we all did it at the same time, but that's not the world we live in. And quite frankly, the language of this doesn't address disarmament or doing anything with the federal government specifically. So my concern is that the unintended consequences of this would be very dramatic for our local economy.
Other opponents say that the ballot question would not stop the production of nuclear weapons anyway. At most, it would shift some of the jobs elsewhere. But proponents want to raise awareness that the nuclear weapons plant is here and that it's controversial.
Coming up, an Iraq War veteran in Kansas City says he's going to end his life, but not before sending an open letter to George Bush. You're listening to KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
Nearly 2 million active duty U.S. servicemen and women are due back home by the end of this year. Many have struggled to reintegrate, but few more profoundly or more publicly than Thomas Young of Kansas City. Young now says he's ready to take his own life, but not before making one more stand against the war that wrecked his body. KCUR's Frank Morris reports.
9/11 touched off a chain of events that transformed Thomas Young from an athletic, rambunctious 22-year-old into a man at the very end of his rope. Young enlisted 2 days after the attacks, moved, he says, by President Bush's vow to punish the Taliban. Young wanted revenge in Afghanistan, but was deployed instead to Iraq, a country that he believed had nothing to do with 9/11. After just days there, a sniper's bullet left him paralyzed from the chest down, impotent and very angry. His terse, powerful way with words propelled him to the forefront of the anti-war movement. The documentary Body of War follows Young's activism and physical struggles. In this scene, his mom, Kathy Smith, tries to attach a urine catheter in the back of a car.
Hey, Mom. We generally tend to watch what goes on up there.
I'm trying to move it so it doesn't just go everywhere.
Good plan. Look at that. You got pee on your hand.
I'm glad that it came out and people saw the reality of war.
Young now spends most of his time here lying flat on his back, smoking in his dimly lit bedroom.
But now I can't even watch it because it serves as a reminder of what I used to be able to do.
Because tough as life was for Young 6 years ago, it's worse now. A blood clot lodged in his lungs months after the film came out that damaged his brain, twisting his hands, and left his speech impaired. His mom, Kathy Smith, says it's been a long, hard fight.
To be a paraplegic, deal with that, and to become a strong young man again, and then you wake up and you're quadriplegic, and you can't use your voice, which was what you were learning to use, and so many people wanted him to speak, and then he couldn't speak anymore.
Young spent months in rehab, but then last April 20th, he married a woman named Claudia Cuellar, a Buddhist with a sunny disposition. Young is a pretty devout atheist, but they both love music and literature and share a keen understanding of the hardships of war.
He is, of course, my number one hero, along with all, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam, all veterans. Do you want a cigarette? Do you want us to go out in front?
Yeah, I'll take a cigarette.
Okay.
Cuellar cares for Young full-time, fetching and lighting his cigarettes, bringing his water, crushing his pills. She's hung her spiritual artwork alongside Young's edgier images, posters of Hunter S. Thompson and rock bands. They had hoped to spend a few good years together, but last summer, a horrible new chronic pain hit Young. Doctors cut out his colon, hoping to ease his suffering, and that worked for a while, but the pain came back.
And I decided and that I was no longer going to watch myself deteriorate and decided to do what I was going to do.
In February, Young announced he was going to remove his feeding tube and stop taking the nearly 100 pills a day. Cuellar understands.
I feel like it's a kind of, you know, his body's been mutilated. I mean, he had the injury, but then there's all the surgeries they've done on top of that. It feels dehumanizing.
Kathy Smith respects her son's decision as well. And in the 9 years since he was shot, she's had a lot of time to contemplate losing him.
I've mourned the son that I sent to war that didn't come home. I've mourned the grandchildren that I'll never have. I've mourned the possibilities, the things that that man could have accomplished. The worst part about all of this for me is that none of this had to happen.
And while Young himself is resolved, he's bitter that what turned out to be a false claim of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is leading him to an early grave.
I'm angry that I'm in this situation because of a lie.
Hearing of Young's plight, activist Ralph Nader suggested he write an open letter to former President George Bush and Dick Cheney, one final broadside against the war and its chief proponents.
And so I went along with that and wrote my letter, and I guess that thing's taken off like wildfire, too.
Young's last letter lays blame for the Iraq War's vast cost in human suffering, the Iraqi peoples, Young's, other veterans and their families, squarely at the feet of Bush and Cheney. But Young insists that while the letter is political, his impending death is entirely personal.
There are people who want to frame it as a political decision or a political issue. That's their prerogative game for them. But I myself don't see it that way.
Young sees it as a release from what seems like intractable suffering. Kim Ruwako, who lost her husband, an Iraq War veteran, to suicide, fears others will see the same opportunity.
I do worry about that. I do worry about the veterans hearing his story and thinking, you know what, he's giving up, I should give up.
Ruwako is with the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, or TAPS, a group that helps families of military suicides.
There are so many veterans out there that are really suffering and are looking to see how other people are handling it.
The women in Thomas's life, his wife and his mother, Kathy Smith, say he's acting with complete honor and dignity.
It's not a suicide. He's not killing himself. He's just stopping.
Young says he'll stop talking with the media next month on his wedding anniversary and likely end his life a month or two thereafter. Frank Morris, KCUR News.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Kearns today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. The U.S. Postal Service is in the midst of a major cost-cutting effort. Besides the possible end of Saturday delivery and the consolidation of major mail centers, there's another move that's hitting home in rural America. The Postal Service plans on cutting staff and hours at about 13,000 post offices. Harvest Public Media's Bill Wheelhouse takes us to a town in the Midwest that will likely feel the impact.
It's rush hour in Nillwood, Illinois. Here in the parking lot in front of the post office each morning. You see, there's no mail delivery in the town. The 230 or so residents have to pick it up themselves. A car pulls in the lot in front of the building every 10 minutes or so. Doris Love stopped by and goes through her mail on this March morning.
My local newspaper today, this is Thursday, so we get all the local news and whatever, and Monday, we get all the advertisements and all those good things to let us know what's going on.
In rural communities like Nillwood, the local post office is still a connection to information, be it through the paper that comes in the mail or the chat with the postmaster. These tiny post offices may not quite be an endangered species, but their way of life is threatened. The Postal Service has proposed reducing the hours of a lot of post offices. Many of those are in small towns. Love says she doesn't like the idea of a cut.
I think it would be terrible. Where would I get my mail? I'd have to drive somewhere else, some other town, or I don't know how it would happen. It would be very inconvenient.
Back in 2011, the Postal Service announced it would close about 4,000 post offices, including this one in Nillwood, which is about 35 miles south of Springfield, the state capital. After an outcry, the Postal Service backtracked and came up with a reorganization plan. It will cut the hours in half at many of the smallest post offices and do away with the job of postmaster in those towns. There are a couple of reasons for the Postal Service's fiscal problems. One is the congressional requirement to prepay retirement benefits. The Postal Service also blames email, online bill paying, and other modern technology reducing the use of first-class mailing. Yet it is rural areas that are least able to take advantage of the high-tech conveniences. There is less access to high-speed internet in small country towns. Steve Hutkins runs the website SaveThePostOffice.com.
People stop by, say hi to each other, that sort of thing, and they share information about what's going on in the town. In my post office, there's a bulletin board with everything from, you know, a lost dog to the bake sale. The post office helps bind the town together, and the postal system helps bind the country together.
What will probably happen to Nillwood has already happened at several thousand post offices across the country, a massive reduction in the hours of operation. On a grander scale, it gives those who study rural America pause. Timothy Collins, assistant director of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University, says the post office reductions reflect a greater issue.
Over perhaps the past 10 or 15 years, there's been what I call a phased withdrawal, if you will, of the federal government from rural America.
Collins cites reductions in federal support for soil conservation programs and for extension services as a couple of examples. He says it is a reversal of eight decades where government was the last helper for people in rural areas. Back in Nillwood, Phil Starks, who served as mayor of the community during the 1990s, says he is skeptical of any plan that says there will be savings by cutting or getting rid of a small post office.
If they did, the money that they saved, them dumbasses in Washington spend it, so that's the way I feel about it.
The Postal Service is holding hundreds of meetings on the fate of small post offices in the coming weeks. For now, Nillwood has not received notice of plans or meetings to discuss any changes at their post office. But Nillwood residents can expect some type of mail in the next year, not bearing good news for them. Bill Wheelhouse, Harvest Public Media.
She fell from the sky, she fell very far, and Kansas, she says, is the name of the star.
Kansas, she says, is the name of the star.
Love it or hate it, the 1939 movie The Wizard of Oz established Kansas on the global map. And if you're from Kansas, or even from Kansas City, Missouri, no matter where you go in the world, somebody's going to make a crack about Dorothy or Toto. Or how about this witty remark? You're not in Kansas anymore, are you? The latest Hollywood blockbuster, Oz the Great and Powerful, brings it all back. The movie tells the backstory of the wizard, who also happened to hail from the Sunflower State.
Step this way! See the most wondrous sights imaginable!
Kansas is full of good men. I don't want to be a good man. I want to be a great one.
Not everyone here locally is trying to escape the legacy of the Wizard of Oz. Joining us now is one Kansan who can't get enough of Oz in her life. Jane Albright is a director of the International Wizard of Oz Fan Club. She got into it as a kid.
I grew up in Topeka, Kansas, in a house that had a shelf of Oz books. The Wizard of Oz is the first in a series of books that eventually grew to be 40 titles, and I wanted to read all the books. I had to borrow them from neighbors and acquire them over the years. That turned me into a collector. In college, I won a book collecting contest, and people began asking me questions about Oz as a piece of literature, or about the biographer, or about the MGM film. And I usually didn't know the answers. So at that point, I started reading the reference books and the biographies and material about Oz until now, here I am 30 years later, just fully immersed.
So now you're a total Oz expert, I would say.
Well, there are people who are published whose expertise I would bow to in a heartbeat, but I do know an awful lot about Oz.
International Oz Club. Now, what, pray tell, does it do?
The International Wizard of Oz Club was founded back in 1957 by a teenage boy who collected Oz books. And he approached other people who he knew were interested in Oz, primarily from fan mail that had written to the man who was writing Oz books at the time, and an exhibit that was mounted at the Columbia Library. And he wrote everyone who was interested and asked, do you want to join an Oz Club? And he rounded up a 20 or so people, and now, 50 years later, we are more like 1,000 people. It's a nonprofit educational organization. We publish a very credible journal, The Bomb Bugle, and meet annually, publish rare and unusual Oz material that we make available for sale.
Now, where is the organization based out of?
We do have an office in San Francisco, but we are a volunteer, entirely volunteer-run organization. So everyone who contributes is working out of their own homes all over the country.
So is there a local Oz Club, too?
There is not. In fact, with Oz the Great and Powerful coming out, I emailed all of the members I could find in the greater Kansas City, if you stretch that up to the edge of Oklahoma and into Kansas area. And there were only about 20 of us right around here. 6 of us went to see the film together the opening night.
So you mentioned that this has been, you know, a longtime passion for you. Why do you care about the story of Oz so much? Are there themes that mean a lot to you?
The book of The Wizard of Oz is not presented as a dream. Oz is a real place. So the subsequent books in the series create a very strong, growing sense of place as more and more characters and activities and adventures take place there. As a young reader, I wanted to go to Oz. It was a very real place to me. But obviously, I outgrew that when I was in college, and that's kind of when I shifted over to being more of a collector. Now it's this incredible network of people that I know all over the country, all over the world, who love Oz, and being connected and networked with them is incredibly satisfying. I really have great fun as a collector, finding and acquiring things that I've looked for years, or finding things that other people I know want and directing them to pick them up is really fun and satisfying.
So you mentioned the members. What lengths do these members go to express their devotion to Oz?
I know people who have purchased a second home to house their Oz collection. 2 or 3 individuals whose collections are so massive that they've been able to open private museums. There are people who appear in character regularly, and that's the way they express their interest. Gosh, a number of Oz fans write their own original fan fiction or do a lot of artwork, illustration, either for books or just as freestanding fine art. There's really no limits.
Now, you mentioned earlier that a lot of Oz fans collect memorabilia and that you have a collection. So tell me about it.
My collection fills the third floor of my home in Hyde Park. I had to eventually divide up the space to where I have sort of a library area, which is five or six floor-to-ceiling bookcases filled with Oz books, other books the authors wrote under their own or pseudonyms, other names, books illustrated by the illustrators of Oz, international translations. I have hundreds of international foreign language translations, a lot of material from Wicked, the phenomenally successful stage musical, and the original book by Gregory Maguire. Another corner, if you will, of the floor is taken over with toys, games, dolls, housewares, children's furniture. I have probably a dozen file cabinets, glass cases loaded with ephemera, a life-size Wicked Witch, you know, that I picked up last Halloween at a Spirit Halloween store, stands in a corner, and when I turn her on, she talks to you if you walk in front of her. It's crazy. My rarest and most unusual things are generally books, and describing them takes a long time because you have to understand the context to appreciate their interest. The more general Oz fan who walks in is usually most interested to see. I have bars of Over the Rainbow handwritten by Harold Arlen on a piece of paper that I'm just thrilled to have that particular piece. I have a lot of merchandise that was released with the 1939 film. Dolls, figural soaps, Valentines, paper masks, some things that are particularly scarce and other things that are probably not so much. I have a wonderful little collapsible cup. You know, those little, they look like a pillbox, but then you expand them up. For the 200th performance of The Wizard of Oz on Broadway in 1903, everyone in the audience was given one of these little collapsible cups with the fact that it was The Wizard of Oz 200th performance engraved on the bottom. And I have that little cup in its original box.
Let's turn to the new movie.
Oz the Great and Powerful.
Oz the Great and Powerful. So I take it you've seen it more than once.
I've seen it twice.
And what do you think? Do you think it really is true to the spirit of the original movie? Or
nearly everyone asks that question. And the MGM movie, the classic one you're referring to with Judy Garland, is one of maybe 40 Wizard of Oz movies that have been made since the earliest one appeared in 1910. So for a collector like me, I don't think so much of The Great and Powerful compared to the MGM film as The Great and Powerful compared to a much larger idea of what Oz is. I think it's children will like it, and I think that's what would have mattered most to the author. It's certainly not L. Frank Baum's vision of Oz. It's not exactly MGM's vision of Oz, but then neither's Wicked. It's a wonderfully fun film. It does do a lot of homage to the MGM movie, starting in black and white. He gets caught in a tornado. He follows the yellow brick road. He has to kill a witch. Things that only appeared in the very first Oz book, so, and in the MGM film. But, you know, it's completely its own story. And I think people need to go to it open-minded and look at it that way and just be able to enjoy it for what it is. The scenery's beautiful. What people can do now with, oh, those beautiful character-generated animations and sequences. We've never had a film that could do that before, and it's really lovely to see Oz come to life with all that color and magic.
So, you know, when you think about people who live in Kansas and the jokes that they endure about being in Kansas, certainly The Wizard of Oz is one of the jokes that people will say, oh, you know, where's Dorothy and Toto if mm-hmm. you live in Kansas? So do you think Kansans and Kansasitians might have the opposite reaction to The Wizard of Oz, that, you know, well, maybe they can't stand to hear anything about it, or they think it's a stereotype of where they live?
That's certainly a legitimate reaction a lot of people could feel, depending on how they feel about Oz. From my perspective, Dorothy considered being from Kansas a wonderful thing. In one of the later Oz books, a princess asks her if she is of royal blood, and she says, oh, no, better than that, I'm from Kansas. She loved being from Kansas, and it was not described in the sort of negative sense that people attributed to the Depression era 1930s Kansas that was depicted in the MGM film. So that's part of that. And the other thing is just what you said, wherever you go, anywhere, you say you're from Kansas and people say Dorothy. Mm-hmm. There is no other state in America that has an association that people feel good about all over the world. The Wizard of Oz has been translated into literally every language. There's a whole series of Oz books in Russia where Ellie and her little dog Tatoshka are as well known as Dorothy and Toto are here. It's been a live-action film in Turkey. There are animated movies in Japan. Everywhere people know Oz, and they know Kansas. You know, I just don't know what would happen if you were running around most of the countries of the world and said you were from where? Tennessee, West Virginia, Idaho? There's just not that strong and positive and smiling a response as we Kansans get.
So now I have to ask you, in terms of your friends and your circle and your family, do they ever say to you, Jane, enough about Oz already?
All the time. I often say when I'm asked to talk about Oz, thank you, because I'm usually asked to stop talking about Oz. I do contain the Oz collection on the third floor. I'm not one of these collectors who, if you go into my kitchen and open the cupboard doors, all the, you know, glasses or jelly glasses with Wizard of Oz on them. And I don't have Oz artwork all over the walls outside the third floor. So I managed to kind of contain it that way. My husband does prefer that I not piggyback family vacations on Oz events that I want to attend. We'd kind of like to separate those. Which is only hard because I have really dear friends all over the country, and wherever I am, I want to go see them. So sometimes there's a little bit of a juggle there. My daughter doesn't connect with my love of Oz particularly. She certainly appreciates some of our good friends, people we've vacationed with and know well. But I'm definitely the only one in my family who is smitten with Oz as I am.
Well, thank you for being with us on KC Currents.
My pleasure. I'll be happy to be here anytime.
Jane Albright is a director of the International Wizard of Oz Fan Club. See photos of her extensive collection of Oz memorabilia at the website kcur.org. Click on Arts and Culture.
After the break, local musician Ashley Miller moves away from experimental music and into an African groove. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Kansas City talk radio pioneer Walt Bodine died at 92. The Wichita State Shockers made it to the Final Four, and police made quick work of a robbery and homicide near the plaza. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Police say two guys decided to rob a house near UMKC where they'd been to a party one time, and one of the robbers shot four people because one of them recognized him. Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker wouldn't comment on that, but did say,
crime, even when it's a planned robbery, is usually planned very poorly.
The two men are held on $500,000 bond each. Three shooting victims survived. UMKC student Aaron Markarian died. He was a promising music student majoring in voice. Police and the FBI confiscated computers from St. Anne's Catholic Church in Independence after the IP address showed up as having downloaded child pornography. Diocese Public Information Officer Jack Smith said it could have been a neighbor or someone in a car outside, though. The wireless network was unsecured.
It will be now. We've not given any, the parishes any directives about securing their Wi-Fi connections, but we certainly will do that now.
The FBI is analyzing the hard drives. No arrests have been made. Medicaid expansion remained a major issue in the state capitals. In Kansas, Governor Sam Brownback didn't sound like a man about to commit to a big expansion.
What I want to do is something that we can afford and carry the freight for the long period.
Republicans in Missouri proposed an answer they said would be affordable. Add 180,000 low-income adults to Medicaid, but end the program for others, including 44,000 children with family incomes above 100% of poverty level. Some advocates of the Democratic plan, like Brent Hemphill, who represents the Missouri Ambulance Association, said they'd settle for that.
We don't necessarily agree with everything in the bill, but we think it's a good start and we need to continue to move this forward.
The same week, the Missouri House passed a budget with no Medicaid expansion. Kansas City, Missouri finalized its budget. The plan increases funding for street maintenance sixfold, and several other items got substantially more money. But Mayor Sly James said,
"Our only regret is that we don't have any money. It would be nice if we had a budget where we actually had an increase of substantial size so that we could do some of the things that need to be done. Unfortunately, that's not the case, at least not yet."
The city also celebrated the announcement of plans for a 100,000-square-foot greenhouse project to grow produce in the riverfront area near downtown. In postseason basketball, two Kansas teams, KU and Wichita State, to the Sweet 16. And what does a guy say to memorialize Walt Bodine, who died at 92 last weekend? What a career. From playing newscaster in a drugstore at Linwood and Troost to doing the news on WDAF, through conversation, night beat, television, books, Walt was working for me at KMBZ in 1981 when he told me KCUR had made him an offer. I tried to talk him out of it. Looking back at the role he played in making public radio in Kansas City what it is today, we're all so fortunate I couldn't persuade him. So let's hear it one more time, for old time's sake, for all of us.
What do you say to that?
We say thanks, Walt. This is KCUR.
To a lot of local music fans, Ashley Miller's new sound might be a little shocking. Not because it's noisy or avant-garde, but because it's not. Miller's usually one of Kansas City's most experimental musicians. But he now has a new band and a new recording, delivering bright African-inspired grooves with spiritually themed lyrics. Ashley Miller says that becoming a father has changed not just his music, but the way he thinks about art. Casey Current's Alex Smith has the story.
Well, I rolled up my earmuffs and I shot in my hooves. I knew there was only one way up, so I sunk into what I would.
For years, musician and songwriter Ashley Miller has challenged listeners with music like this track, Tea Cake at the Top. Jerky, disjointed, and chaotic, Miller's music has seemed like a puzzle that may or may not have an answer. His live performances could be funny, freaky, or scary, depending on his mood. Miller had the reputation of being one of Kansas City's most far-out musicians. But about a year and a half ago, Miller's work took a surprising change of course. He decided he wanted to make music that would make people happy.
This, it's been really intentional what emotions are cultivated, where before it was maybe I was greedy or, you know, just wanted to seduce people or something. Now it's more like, okay, this is a responsibility. I need to wield this with on purpose and try to cultivate love and delight and joy.
Ashley Miller traces his artistic change to another big change in his life. In the summer of 2011, his daughter Aiko was born, and Ashley felt a special responsibility to this newest listener.
I knew for the first time that the way that I was feeling would be shown directly back to me by someone else. I know that she's going to hear what I make, because that's what I'm doing all the time. And I know that there's no way to hide it. You know, hide where it's really coming from, because children have that nature to just reveal things as they actually are. So if it's coming from the sort of like dark emotions or the lower centers of gravity, you know, it's going to be revealed.
You'll be staring straight into the central sun. It feels so great to see that you're related to the only one.
On a recent weekday afternoon, Ashley Miller sat behind the giant mixing board at his home studio and offered a preview of his upcoming recording, Metatone, by his new band by the same name. Out of the big twin speakers bounced chirpy guitars and chattering beats, influenced by the pop music of Kenya and Nigeria.
I'm really inspired by African music, deeply, deeply. Just the vibe, and they just have this incredible ability to deal with the most complicated, heavy content, but it's all ecstatic musically, which is really appealing to me. Just unrelentingly groovy, too.
Lots of musicians find their comfort zone away from the edges and extremes. Miller, on the other hand, says taking the middle road and making accessible songs is a lot harder for him than making his usual surreal music.
It's funny, it's more on the edge for me because I'm really safe in those places because you can just disappear into mayhem. It's really easy. So this has been actually, to me, is more risky because it's very vulnerable to stay right in the middle and just hold the center. And that to me is really noisy, actually. That to me is really edgy and noisy, is to filter out all of the other ideas that are really exotic or really heavy.
The spiritual lyrics of Metatone can be equally heavy or glib, even irreverent. They hint at Christianity one minute, Buddhism the next, and New Age after that. The songs reflect what Ashley calls internet spirituality, borrowing from whatever faith or philosophies grab his attention. While Miller has been involved in numerous bands and countless projects, he plans on sticking with Metatone for a while, and the new perspective that's come with being a father is likely to have a long-lasting effect on his music.
It's deeply influenced it in the most profound way possible. I feel like I have a one-to-one connection with my own purpose, and it's a very humbling thing to just be a human being and understand that you have a very, very, very limited skill set. And you just kind of have to say yes to yourself.
Despite all the changes Ashley Miller's been through, he hasn't lost his love for the absurd. As the afternoon ended and Miller finished previewing the Metatone songs, he made a request for this radio story.
I would just request that we put in 10 seconds of total silence into the end of the interview. Oh, and all, okay, and can I say something right before the silence happens? Mm-hmm. Okay, everyone, the silence is going to happen. And as soon as it does, notice that you're noticing. And then try to notice who is noticing. Awesome.
For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
Well, we thank you for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Zach Lewandowski and Monica Sandretsky. Theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.